This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to the show. I'm Mira Siviso, the Eat Our Health and Living segment, and it is also our Ask a Doctor session. And today we're going to be discussing childhood fevers. Dr. Sanjay Woodhull, consultant pediatrician, on the line with me. He's going to be happy to answer any of your questions on fever as far as children are concerned. Give us a call. The number is 7733 2900. You can WhatsApp 018 789 8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. Welcome to the show, Dr. Sanjay. How are you today?
Hello. Hi, Mira. Thank you for inviting me. I look forward to this.
You're most welcome. I mean, I still cannot understand how 12 and a half years have gone by and we've not had you on the show. And this is the first time. And
absolutely. Hopefully not the last.
Yeah. And you're a pretty prominent pediatrician. I'm like, how did we not allow this man on? Okay. Let's talk about fevers, Dr. Sanjay. Sure. What there have been a lot of controversies when it comes to fever in children. Mm-hmm. You want to just elaborate what these controversies are?
Okay. The controversies in respect to care of children with fever are both in respect to the parents managing fever and the healthcare professionals or the physicians, pediatricians managing fever. And for example, I ran a survey, more than 100 colleagues of mine, looking at practices in terms of how they monitor temperature, what thermometers do they use, what medication would they use? Would the fevers are high, would they use more medication or combine medications? I'm also looking at, would they use suppositories, for example? So there is so much of variance. The evidence is fairly clear as to what you should be done. But for some reason, everyone's doing their own thing. And I thought I'd like to set the record straight and perhaps allay a lot of fears that parents may have with respect to managing fever in children.
Okay. First of all, let's just go back to basics. A fever indicates something not right. The body is fighting something, Dr. Sanjay. But what exactly constitutes a fever in a child? Are there different things to be aware of when it comes to babies and young children versus older children?
Okay. So let's start with what normal temperature is. So in general, we consider 37 degrees as normal. But there's a variance, like our heart rate and blood pressure. So anything between 36.8 right up to 37.8 in adults and children, and really up to 38 degrees Celsius in infants would be considered normal. So in short, if you have a temperature of above 30 degrees Celsius, that's considered fever.
38 for infants or for children?
Yeah. So that would be a cutoff point for us to define that your child's having a fever.
Why is it so different for the children?
Well, there is variance. The likelihood is their metabolic rate's a little bit higher, and therefore they may have a slightly higher temperature. But particularly in small babies, the neonates, a lot of the babies get wrapped and overwrapped. So they're more sensitive to external temperature. So therefore, you may tend to have a little bit of a tick up, but we really don't expect it to go past 38. If it's past that, then really we're looking at this being a more of an infective episode, perhaps.
Okay. And what's happening in the body when the fever develops?
Okay. So when you have a temperature, typically it is due to either an infective or a non-infective cause. The commonest, and I think by far more than 95-97% of the time, it's infective. When I say infective, be it a viral infection or a bacterial infection, when it gets into our body, what then happens is our body recognizes it. We've got special cells in our body called macrophages, and they will produce certain chemicals, kind of cytokines. I know with COVID-19, many people are now a little bit more familiar with this term cytokines. There are particular chemicals that were triggered upon experiencing certain infections in our body. And what those cytokines do, they will travel into our bloodstream, and from our bloodstream, it travels all the way up to our thermostat that sits in the center of our brain. That's called the hypothalamus. So if you can imagine your home air conditioner has got a thermostat.
Yeah.
You set it at 20 degrees Celsius, and it will keep running till you get the temperature, then you switch off. And the same thing happens to our body. So we set our thermostat at 37, and our body will very finely regulate it to between 37.5 to 36.8, but keep it around there. But when these cytokines come in play, it will then reset the thermostat. So you started at 37, with the chemicals coming in, it goes up to 39, perhaps 40. So your body will then try to work. And how it works is by muscle activity, by liver metabolism. And by doing that, it gets your temperature in your body going up. What we measure is the core temperature to the set temperature at hypothalamus. So that's really how it works.
And where does it get thrown off? Where you need to start taking paracetamol, or you even need a suppository, things like that. Why is it? What is it that's not functioning enough that helps to regulate that temperature?
Okay, so I think fever in itself is a survival benefit. It's an evolutionary benefit. We do recognize, and there's good evidence to show, that if you can mount a fever response towards an infection, you tend to survive better. So it's evolutionary. It is actually good. If you can imagine, it's part of our defense system. All right? So when you have fever, the main concern or the indication is, okay, there's an infection or something going on, some inflammatory response is going on, but it will cause discomfort to the child. When that happens, then the automatic response is, okay, let's give something to get a child comfortable. And then comes the fear medicines. But what they don't recognize, or what many people don't recognize, it actually may help protect you against the infection getting worse. And that's also pretty good evidence for that.
So if you do give a child Panadol, what are you actually doing?
Okay, so it's mainly, the focus is mainly for comfort. To recognize that fever is going to help get your child get over the infection quickly. At the same time, you want to give comfort. So the general rule, and I'll sum it up, is simply three things. If your child has fever, there really is three things we recommend to do currently. And that's something I do routinely in my practice. And that is fever medication, fluids, and rest. And really, that's it and nothing else.
Okay. And, you know, you tend to see children sometimes, or some children at least, you find that their fever, some children have their fevers shooting up all of a sudden towards 39, sometimes even closer to 40. Where does that happen with the children? And then you worry about, then some children go into having a seizure. Is that necessarily something we should be overly concerned about?
They're probably one of the commonest concerns both parents and physicians have. When the fever shoots up very high, 39, 40, is it going to cause a seizure? Is it going to cause brain damage? And is it going to cause any permanent disability? Essentially not. So fever in itself will not cause brain damage. Fever in itself will not cause any permanent disability. Now, there is less than 5% of children, when they develop a fever that goes past 38.5 or 39, they may have a risk of developing a fever, and that's called a febrile fit. And these are the children that's between 6 months to 5-6 years of age. To some extent, the brain is not particularly mature as yet, and therefore they are a little bit more susceptible to developing a seizure. It's frightening to see.
Yeah.
It lasts less than a minute or two. It will not cause harm. And very often it's just reassurance. But whenever a fever and fit were to occur, as a physician, our worry is, are we dealing with something serious? Are we dealing with a brain infection? Are we dealing with meningitis, for example? So that's our job, to ensure that nothing serious is going on. But it's important to recognize that in children where they are susceptible to having febrile fits, fever medication cannot prevent it. If you're going to have it, you're going to have it, irrespective of whether you take fever medicines or not.
Even suppositories, throwing your child in an ice tub, all of that doesn't help.
Again, that's hugely controversial, you know. And I'll share my experience again with you with the survey we did locally. Mm-hmm. So in respect to the guidance of using tepid sponging, as you would put it, throwing a child in a tub, when you have high fever, what is the current practice? And my survey was done maybe 6 months ago, so this is fairly new. Not surprising, 80% of respondents, and I'm talking about pediatricians, would want to tepid sponge. Okay. That's 80%. Mm-hmm. Today, a child gets into my hospital and gets into ER into my ward with a temperature of 39, invariably, my nurses are going to sponge. Now, what that happens, is because of the fear of fever.
Yeah.
The worry that fever is going to cause damage. They need to understand that fever does not cause damage. When you tepid sponge, what may happen is that your temperature on your skin may cool down momentarily. What sponging doesn't do, it does not reset your thermostat. Your thermostat is stuck at 39. No matter what, it's at 39. So when you sponge, your skin temperature drops, your body recognizes it, and now it's trying to elevate the temperature. And how it does it is by shivering. So you will tend to find when you dunk a child who's having high fever, they'll start to shiver.
Yeah.
And the more they shiver, the more ice water is going to go on them. And the more they shiver. So you're going to get a lot of discomfort. Now, ultimately, we answer the question by looking at the evidence. So the evidence suggests if you were to give fever medication and tepid sponge versus just giving fever medicines, which is better, it suggests fever medication alone tends to be, in fact, a little bit better than using sponging. So ultimately, we need to run through trials. Now, the guidance I'm talking about is both from the UK and the US do not recommend tepid sponging.
Okay. Those are some of the
controversies. That's a major shift in care. It's a major shift.
Absolutely.
And I'm telling you, pediatricians are still doing it. So it's a challenge.
Yeah. So what are parents supposed to do if your child indeed has got a fever of 39 degrees? You give them fever meds, and what do we do? Head to
ALE? So again, I'm going to write through with you. It's only three things.
Mm.
In this entire talk, you remember just what these three things is good enough. And that's fever medication, fluids, mm-hmm. and rest. Three things. There's really nothing else you can do. Of course, I get the other spectrum of the problem, wherein now you've got a fever running at 39. You give paracetamol, for example. And after an hour and a half, the fever is at 39 still. So then comes sponging. And after an hour, the temperature is now 40. There's a lot of anxiety and stress. And part of that stress and anxiety that parents have gone through is, I suspect, as a result of a prior visit to a healthcare physician, for example. So when you come into a doctor, and then you measure temperature 39, the first thing they're going to do is sponge the child and then put a suppository in. Now, that's reinforcing that this fever is serious. I need to get down to it and treat it right away. Even though you may not tell the patient that, the suggestion you've suggested to the patient, this is something serious. We need to act on the fever right away. In reality, the job of the physician or your pediatrician is, why is your child having a fever? That's my job. And then to determine whether this fever is serious or not.
So how would we know as parents?
Okay. So the general rule you should follow is simply this. If the bulk of our febrile children, now in any pediatric practice, almost a third to a quarter of our patients that we see on a daily basis is due to a febrile illness. So it's a fairly common problem we see. In general, preschool children, and I'm talking about six and under, almost 70 to 80% of the time, it's viral. And if it's viral, they tend to run a course wherein they have high fever intermittently for the first 2 days, perhaps 3 days. And then by the third to fourth day, the fever tends to get further, milder. The child tends to get more active. The appetite starts to return. You know you're dealing with something that's not particularly serious. In the first 48 hours, it can be a bit of a challenge because either viral or bacterial, they can still look fairly unwell. The worry is, if it's bacterial, then you may want to start antibiotics. So consider starting antibiotics, or at least consider doing tests. So in general, I tell my patients, sit tight for the first 2 days. As long as your child has had all the recommended vaccines, it's very unlikely we're missing anything serious. More likely, it's a benign viral illness. And what's important in that first 48 hours is, during the fever episodes, you give your paracetamol and see how your child behaves. So if the child's after an hour or two, the fever tends to settle, they tend to be more active and cheerful, you have time on your hands. But despite fever medication, in the next 3 to 4 hours, the child persistently becomes unwell, sleeps most of the day, looks lethargic, of course has seizures come in.
This is what, after 2-3 days or even
in the first 2 to 3 days.
Okay.
If your child has high fever, it doesn't mean 39 come in. It doesn't mean that. it means 39, give your fever medicines and then watch for the next 3 to 4 hours. If when the fever settles, most children tend to be active.
Okay.
If that happens, there's no immediate urgency to run in. But if you don't see that in the first 48 hours, then come in.
Okay. Because, after a while, after being chirpy and everything, then you find the fever coming back again,
correct,
isn't it? After
then you go down for a while, yeah, then your meds, then your fluids, then your rest, then they get up again. That's good news.
Okay. So it's only if it's consistently lethargy,
yeah,
and, okay.
Correct.
Then panic.
Vomiting, lethargy, seizures, sleeping most of the time, then yes, come in.
Okay. We're discussing childhood fevers with Dr. Sanjay Woodhull, consultant pediatrician. If you have a question for us, it's 7733 2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, or tweet us at BFM Radio. Good afternoon and welcome back. It's our Ask a Doctor series on health and living. We're discussing childhood fevers. Dr. Sanjay Woodhull, consultant pediatrician, on the line with me. It's interesting. Just a quick recap to what you were saying, Dr. Sanjay. Normal temperature 36.8 to maybe 37.8. Anything above, it is considered a little bit of a fever. 38 degrees for infants. But what's really interesting is, I wish I'd spoken to you a long time ago. I used to panic at 38 degrees and start medicating and start worrying, goes to 39 and I'm already perspiring myself, and 39.5 and that's it, you're ready to run to A&E, right? So you're saying chill, listen,
yes,
fever medications, fluids and rest, after which the child probably get through it and then become active again and probably go into a fever again, and you're saying that is really quite acceptable, normal,
yes,
for 2 to 3 days. Only if it is persistently high throughout is when a child is lethargic, sleeping throughout, then there's something that you need
persistent
to think about.
Vomiting, yep.
Okay.
Not feeling well, yep.
Okay. This is a very basic question. And I know pediatricians like you would love these sort of questions. There's a question here about, what about home remedies? Forehead patches, sweating it out. Some people say don't use paracetamol, natural remedies like coconut water, turmeric milk, ginger, garlic concoctions. What's your take on these?
I've got a few more to add to that, but never mind. Okay.
Add on, please.
Of all the concoctions listed, there is only perhaps two things that directly resets your thermostat. So that's the primary target of managing or treating fever. You need to reset the thermostat, bring it back from 39 down to 37. And the only thing that really does that is fever medication. So you either use paracetamol or another group of medications called NSAIDs, or like things like aspirin or ibuprofen. So those are the common two medications we use in children. So paracetamol or ibuprofen. Everything else does not work. I hope that kind of answers it.
There's a suppository. What is that for?
Okay. So suppositories are also same thing. They are medications for fever. So they can paracetamol, suppositories, and you've got what we use commonly in Malaysia is something called Voltran. They are non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs. They're the aspirin killer drugs, which are also used because the concern is that when should I use a suppository when my child is having high fever? Should I use it? The belief is that it works faster, it's more effective. Unfortunately, that's wrong for two reasons, really. Firstly, the suppository absorption is very erratic. It all depends on how deep you push it, which means the deeper it goes in, the more the medication goes through something called a first-pass metabolism, which means the deeper you go in, the faster it gets metabolized in the liver. Therefore, it becomes less effective. So if you don't push it as deep, then perhaps it's a little bit more effective. Now, don't ask me how deep or how shallow. I can't answer that. All right? It's all very arbitrary.
Yeah.
So that's why we don't quite recommend fever medicines. But personally, I would think, and I would think most of my friends I know as well, don't like anything stuffed behind their bums.
No.
And that applies for children as well. Please, mums and dads, remember this, okay? So try to serve medication orally. There are very few reasons why we use rectally. And that would be if your child's refusing oral medicine. There are some children like that, they just refuse syrups. There are children who continuously vomit. And if the fever is high and they remain concerned, okay, for those reasons, you would try to use suppositories. not regularly, but when necessary. And I'm just going to move on to a little bit of a different topic. And that's because in respect to, okay, you tell me now, I'm going to expect fever regularly in the first 48 hours. Should I then be giving fever medicines every 4 to 6 hours? Because I know the first 2 days, the fever is going to be going up and down. And the recommendation or guidance is no. You'd give your fever medicines when necessary only.
Why?
Because it comes back to the fact that fever is a defense mechanism. It comes back to the idea that fever actually gets the infection under control faster. There are many reasons or theories or ideas as to why this is, but we do recognize that the mere fact you have fever inhibits viral bacterial growth. We do also recognize that fever tends to stimulate or wake up your immune system, tells your immune system, listen, there's an infection going on. So it builds more soldiers. It gets your soldiers, your antibodies more active. So it clearly does bring down the infection period faster if you have a fever on board. Now, I'll take it a little bit step further. And that is evidence back in 1800s, in the late 1800s. There's something called Cooley's broth. I don't know whether you heard of that.
Never.
It's a nasty broth of streptococci for the treatment of something called erysipelas. So there was this doctor, I think his name was William Cooley. And what he did was he recognized that in New York, patients that came to him with terminal cancer. So these are solid tumor cancers, terminal. They're going to die in a couple of months and they got nowhere else to go. So they go, they meet him, and he decided to try this. So he gives them this bacteria. And what the intention is for him to trigger a febrile response. That febrile response stimulates the immune system. That immunological response results in a fair number of his patients having complete remission of the tumor.
Wow.
So that is currently being studied as well. Because fever, we do recognize, has significant benefits. It's a little bit out of topic, but really, I'm trying to get you all to understand that it's not all bad. And you just need to recognize why there's fever. And as long as you're sure your child's gone through all the vaccines, it's really unusual for it to be something serious.
What about things like meningitis? I mean, we read about that all the Correct. Time, right?
When I first started practice, I think in the early 90s, we get meningitis pretty much every week. I'm doing lumbar punctures every week. But ever since the government started the Haemophilus influenza meningitis vaccine, we hardly ever get it. And now with pneumococcal vaccine, it's rarer still. It's so rare to get meningitis now. So the meningitis we're getting is most of the time viral meningitis, not bacterial. So it's very uncommon.
What's the difference between viral and bacterial?
It's just a bug. It's there are a number of viruses, anything from dengue to hand foot mouth disease, herpes infections can cause infections in the brain. That's been around, but it's very rare. Big hospitals like ours would see it, but it's a challenge to manage. But by and large, these children, within hours, they're almost comatose. They're very, very sick. You'll be rushing into a hospital right away versus a child who's having fever and then getting better and active in between. Those you have time to wait.
All right. Which brings me to a question from Cheryl. Ever since I read that fever is one of the signs of cancer in children, it's freaked me out. The information online is not really clear on how fever in cancer is different from other normal fevers. How paranoid should I get when my son has a fever?
Okay. Very, very good question. Thank you for that. Okay, so when you talk about fever and your child has fever, remember this. It's either infective or non-infective. So either an infection causing it or something else. Bulk of the cause, and I'm talking more than 95% time, it is due to an infection. And if it's due to an infection, if it's a preschool child, almost always it's viral. Why is it important? Because you don't need antibiotics. Fluids, fever medicines, rest. 2 days, they're fine. There are some viral infections, of course, we are more concerning. Dengue is top of the list. So typically, when you see children on a third day or fourth day of fever looking unwell, most doctors will do a blood test in Malaysia, and mainly to ensure you're not missing dengue. All right. And then they'll do a clinical examination to ensure that everything else is fine. Now, the non-infective is a host. It's a legion. One of the small reasons is cancer. Leukemias can present with fever. Arthritis can present with fever. Any trauma can have fever. If you're low in oxygen, sometimes that can cause fever. So there are many reasons non-infective that can cause fever, but that's very, very remote. But the most serious ones are the ones people talk about the most. And that's why that message sticks. I will also relate to you why parents get very concerned, because a lot of the children are managed by the grandparents. And if you can realize that 25 years ago, 30 years ago or longer, vaccines weren't particularly available, not particularly effective, and many children weren't getting vaccines. And therefore, you will hear a child in some kampong getting a fever yesterday and today either dead or paralyzed for life. That is in their head. And that will then relay down to the parents, who will get all anxious and stressed. And then they come and sit me, come see me the next morning, concerned about this. So it takes maybe for me 2 or 3 visits before they kind of get the clue and idea, okay, that's how I'm going to manage. Because the whole idea is we need to try and empower patients and not so much get them dependent on this, on coming to us ever so often for any fever.
Okay, don't say that laugh. When many, many years ago, more than 30 years ago, I was a kampong girl who was vaccinated. So no, you're looking far beyond that, aren't you?
Let's go 60 years back.
Yes, thank you, yes. I was like, he's talking about me here. question from Sue. How do we know when a fever might be a sign of something serious like COVID, especially with the high cases right now?
Okay, that's obviously a serious concern. So there's children and there's adults. The only way to be sure it is COVID now, because of the community spread, is you need to do a swab test, because we can't rely so much on contact. Of course, if there's contact, then that becomes almost mandatory that you need to do a swab test. But if you're uncertain, sore throat, cough, fever, just go ahead. But children's symptoms are a little bit different. They may have just diarrhea. They may just have sniffle or a flu. But the good news about children, and really we're not so clear about this, is why is it they are not really falling unwell? Why are not we are not seeing any deaths in Malaysia because of children? That's really good. I'm really happy about that. Other countries are seeing different things, but at least in Malaysia, it's good. There's no clear answer as to why, but it doesn't mean fever equals COVID. I think if you're unsure, get yourself tested.
And how young can a child be swabbed? Can an infant be swabbed?
From birth onwards, yeah.
It can be swabbed.
Of course.
Okay.
It's a nasal swab, yeah.
Sure. Next question from Yin. Would the kid get a seizure if there is persisting fever? What are the signs of a seizure to look out for? And how do we handle seizures? Because I'm always worried when they get a high fever and if that would lead to a seizure or a fit. So that's interesting. You've answered some of it. But what do you do when it happens?
Understood. Thanks for that, Yin. Okay. So typically, the risk of a child developing a seizure following a fever happens in the first 24 hours. So it's very unusual on the second day or third day of high fever for them to then develop a seizure. So watch out in the first 24 hours. Now, when the seizure does occur, there are certain rules you need to follow. Number one, don't panic. It's easy to see. It's very easy for me to talk about it, but anyone sees it will panic. To some extent, it looks like a child's going to die. It's so frightening to see that. But that's never going to happen if this is a simple febrile seizure. So what you need to do is not to panic. Lie your child down. Turn your child to either one side. Look at your watch to have an idea as to how long the seizure is going on for. And that's it. Now, there are certain things you should not do. Don't slap your child. Don't pinch your child. Don't stick anything in the mouth. You're just going to injure your child.
I mean, we used to do that back in the day, right? Always hear of people putting in a spoon in the mouth. You don't want your child to bite her tongue or his tongue.
And we see that a lot. So what tends to happen is they get tooth damage. They get lacerations in the mouth. Or the mother's finger will be almost bitten off. So that's what we get to see. So don't do that. Don't do anything. It's just lie down, turn to one side, look at your watch, see how long the fit's going on for. If you have the ability to record the event using your handphone, great. So as a doctor, I can really recognize, yes, I agree with you, this is a seizure. But that's not mandatory. That's something you can consider doing. Now, when would you rush in? if the seizure goes on for more than 3 to 5 minutes, then come in, because it's unusual. Most seizures are seconds to a minute or two, and rarely longer than that.
Okay.
And the other thing would be recurrence. So they have a fit, they have a fever and fit, and then after an hour or two, they fit again. That's not normal. You must come in as well.
Okay. We're discussing childhood fevers with Dr. Sanjay Woodhull, consultant pediatrician. It's our Ask a Doctor series. If you have a question, give us a call right now. It's 7733 2900. You can WhatsApp 018-789-8899. Tweet us at BFM Radio. We'll come back and answer some of your WhatsApp questions. Up next on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Mira Sevasodi. Dr. Sanjay Woodhull, consultant pediatrician, on the line with me, helping us to answer some of the questions that we may have on childhood fevers. If you have a question, you can either give us a call. It's 7733 2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, or tweet us at BFM Radio. Dr. Sanjay, another question via WhatsApp. Hi, I have a question for the doctor. Is it true that when a child has a viral infection, like a cold, but if she's not feverish anymore, she's no longer infectious? Is that true?
Very good question. So typically, it will take between 2 to 5 days, depending on the type of virus, for them not to be infectious. So they're most infectious a day or two prior to the fever coming on, right up to 3 days soon after the fever ends. So, and COVID is a classic example. So you've got COVID, you may have fever for a couple of days, but the 5th or 6th day, your fever settles, but you continue to shed the virus, but the numbers drop fairly exponentially, but there's still a small risk of it for you spreading. But yeah, typically 3 to 5 days, I would think.
Okay. Next question. Should we always stand by medication for fever at home? If so, what would be your recommendation? I remember there is a caution on ibuprofen before due to COVID. Was that?
I guess your readers are very well learned. All the right questions. Yeah. Okay, so yes, the medication that we use commonly in children would be either paracetamol or ibuprofen. I think most of us will err towards using paracetamol. It tends to be we are more familiar in use. We are more familiar with the side effects of it. And its safety profile. So paracetamol will be probably with the first choice versus Europe. In Europe, the first choice is using ibuprofen. It's safe to use either ibuprofen or paracetamol for influenza and for COVID-19. It's equally safe. The evidence is very, very clear about it. Our only tiny concern in Malaysia with the use of ibuprofen-like medication, so all the aspirin group drugs, including Voltran, would be dengue fever. Because in the face of dengue fever, we wouldn't know by the 2nd and 3rd day whether it's dengue. It tends to affect the platelets. So for that reason, we would recommend mainly paracetamol, at least for the first 2 or 3 days. The advantage of ibuprofen, however, is that it lasts longer. It gets the temperature down faster. But then the tiny concern about dengue, if at all it is. So I think either way, you'll be okay with either use of paracetamol or ibuprofen.
Okay, so it's only the dengue that's a fear.
That's right.
And that's interesting. I mean, you know, what we go through on this side of the world is different. We have different viral, diseases, infectious diseases and things like that. But are children any different here on this side of the world compared to children in the West, for an example, in the way we treat them?
Yes. So I think there's a little more guidance in terms of amount of medication to use and the type of medication to use, as I mentioned. But otherwise, not really. I mean, we would still, a fair number of doctors I know in the West still would tap in sponge, but it's not as common as over here.
Okay. And the next question from Muhammad Shani Abdullah. What is the effect of tobacco smoke with regards to fever amongst babies?
Okay.
Say, Dr. Sanjay, just tell the parents to stop smoking.
That's absolutely spot on.
What's holding you back from saying it?
Because this is such a common problem. And the thing is, I do a lot of pediatric respiratory medicine work, and I deal with a lot of children with asthma and chronic lung disease. And there's the one, and you know, I'm digressing a little bit. But I think it's an important message to tell your listeners as well. And it's simply this. When children are diagnosed with asthma, what I tend to find is they have a whole lot of what you call as pantang. You can't have ice cream. You can't have cold drinks. You can't play with friends. You can't swim. You can do a whole lot of things. But when I manage a child with asthma, I tell them there's only one thing, and there's only one important thing you need to avoid, and that's no one should smoke around you.
Nobody should smoke around the child.
And invariably, you know, the mom will be kind of looking at the dad, and the dad will be looking up in the ceiling. So I'll tell him, listen, you want to continue smoking, that's fine. But you remember only three rules. So rule number one, if you want to smoke, is no smoking in the house because it stays in the house for days. Rule number two, don't smoke in the car because it stays in a couple of days. And rule number three, which is, I think, the most challenging, if you want to hug and kiss your child, you can't smoke for a minimum of 8 hours because it stays in your lungs. You can have a shower, you can change your clothes, but as soon as you kiss your child, that child's going to wheeze.
Really?
So if you like your child to come in and see me every time in the ER, by all means, continue smoking.
Okay, I thought my message was bad, but that's even more, that is even more powerful. But, you know, gosh, I had no idea. 8 hours.
Yes.
Okay. Next question. What if my child has intermittent fever over a two-week period? When should I go in?
Very, very good question. And this is something I get very often as well. So parents come to me and say, listen, my child's having fever for 2 weeks. Something's not right. And they come in with a bag of medicines of various colors, similar to a rainbow, quite honestly. So the answer lies in the history taking. And in my experience, more than 90% to 95% of time, these are what we call recurrent infections, not the same infection. So they had a fever, flu, and a cough, perhaps 2-3 days ago. They were well for at least 48 hours or so, and then they picked up a second infection. Those we're not concerned about. We are only concerned if the fever continuously persists 7 to 10 days or more.
Every day.
That is unusual.
Every day.
Every single day. If you need to medicate for more than 7 days to 10 days, that's not normal. That needs further investigations. But the recurrence is very, very common. And to give you an idea of how often this can occur, so in a preschool child, anywhere between 6 to 8 times a year, almost every month, they can have a few flu cough. Which brings me to another problem. And that is the question I get. Okay, doctor, my child's having a fever every month. Can you give me some immune boosters or perhaps some probiotics to help get my child's immune system stronger? And therefore, I don't need to see you every month. The answer to that is, it's normal for your child to have a fever, flu, cough every month. And this is preschool. But the second the child enters school, you're not going to see that anymore. And I also tell them every time a child has an infection, it's actually building your child's immune system. And they're actually going to get stronger. And there's clear evidence to suggest that children who do get preschool infections tend to have less allergies and asthma because you've got a normal functioning immune system. Children who have never had an infection in the first 2-3 years of life tend to have more allergies. So it's actually good to have a bit of infection early on in your life.
Mm-hmm. Goes back to the hygiene hypothesis.
Absolutely.
Okay. Is it safe to bring our kids to the clinic or hospital, especially with the cases of COVID-19?
Yeah, so it's been more than a year plus that we've been battling with this. So most hospitals, clinics have got already very good protocols and SOPs in place to ensure we don't have cross infections. But nonetheless, you're going to a center where people are unwell. And therefore, obviously, there'll be a little bit more risk. Having said that, it's also very important, particularly for children, to get their vaccines. So if you're well, you need to come in for your vaccines because prevention is far better than treatment. So for vaccines, please come in, follow the schedule, it's absolutely safe. If you're having a febrile illness, otherwise, well, safe to wait at least 48 hours. Now, I must say in the last year, we're hardly seeing any more infections. And the main reason is simply because I think everyone's masking and everyone's at home. I used to get pneumonias every week. I've probably had a handful of pneumonias in the last 1 year, all because everyone's masking. So far less number of infections now. But if you think your child's unwell for whatever reason, don't hesitate to come in because it's safe to come.
Okay. Would you like to share any sort of, you know, misconceptions which, you know, you have to deal with all the time? when it comes to fever?
Because fever, okay. So a number of things. I talked to them about why it's important to recognize that fever is a part of your defense system. So I get that out of the way. And then I talked to them how you should measure. And I think the current recommendation is actually using the ear thermometer. So remember that. You can also use a thermometer under the armpit, but please use a digital one. Don't use a glass thermometer. So that's the second important message to take away.
So you don't use glass thermometers anymore?
No, we don't. It can break, it can cause injuries and mercury spillage.
Okay.
So this is a danger. So we use digital thermometers. And digital thermometers nowadays, especially the newer ones, have got new enhanced algorithms and ways of measuring temperatures which are very close to what we call as the core temperature.
Right.
So in the past, we used to use rectal thermometers, but really we avoid that, and the guidance is not to use that anymore.
Okay.
So we just use the ear, and that's fine. Even if your child has earwax, you can still use your ear thermometers. It's just as accurate. You don't need to take out the earwax. But parents will tell me, yeah, but you know, when I measure the right ear is one temperature, the left ear is another temperature, which one do I use? Use the higher one. Whatever it is, use the higher one. Just follow by that.
Okay. Any other misconceptions?
We can go on all day with this.
Please, you got a little bit more time, so you might as well share it.
So it's no tepid sponging. Please remember this is the one thing, because it's going to cause the child a lot of discomfort. It's going to cause your child to shiver, and it's not going to make a difference with the temperature. In fact, you may get the illness prolonging a bit longer. So that's going to be a big shift and change for what you're doing. Now, you listen to me today, but tomorrow your child has a fever and goes to your clinic, you're going to get tepid sponging. So if you can tell your doctors or your healthcare professionals, I'd rather not, they'll be great.
And they're going to say, who told you that rubbish?
Yes. You know? Mention my name, throw it there. I'll be happy to defend you.
So fever, meds, right. Fluids and rest.
Correct. Try not to use suppositories, please.
Any sort of advice to parents to decide when a fever actually warrants a trip to the hospital or even emergency department? I mean, we panic. I have to say we panic.
Sure.
How do we calm ourselves down and think about these things rationally?
Okay. Please ensure that your child's got all the important vaccines. That alone will almost always take away the serious infections. All right. If that's done, our job's easier. As pediatricians, we know, okay, you've done all the vaccines, therefore, most likely, it's nothing serious. Number two would be observing a child in the first 48 hours between the fever episodes. Between the fever episodes, if the child is active, feeding well, no immediate hurry to run in. By the third day, the fever still goes up and down, typically past 38, 3.5. Okay, come in at least for an assessment. And you may need to do it initially, two or three times, you may want to come in earlier. That's fine. Because when you come in, we talk to you, we educate you, we empower you. By the third to fourth visit, now you're more confident. Ah, this doctor told me this is what I should do. So now I'm going to watch. And then by the third to fourth visit, you may not need to come in so often. But I think new parents, it can be a challenge because they really, I can talk and talk and talk, but they'll still come to my clinic. So I said, it's fine, you come in. But then you need to build a rapport and build a confidence. So by all means, the rule to follow is, if you're unsure, come in.
Okay.
And the second important rule is trust the mothers. They got better instincts than fathers.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. I mean, do you really trust the mother's instinct much? I think pediatricians
are more...
I see
this consistently across the board. This is all my years of practice. And of course, I got my wife beating on my head as well, but yes.
Why you don't trust the fathers? Some of them are more hands-on, you know.
Yes, they are. I must credit the fathers because really in the last 10, 15 years, I see so many dads hands-on and coming in with babies, changing the nappies, feeding. So yeah, well done to them.
Well done. Well done. But mother's instincts are still stronger, right?
Yeah. Okay. It's biological.
Okay.
Can't beat the genes.
No, you can't. Thank you very much for joining us and for answering
for
all our
me.
Questions. Dr. Sanjay Woodhull, consultant pediatrician in our Ask a Doctor series on childhood fevers on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.